The sunshine faces.
I will call the first case, 96-039-D, in the matter of disciplinary proceedings against William Pangman, representing Mr. Pangman, representing Ms. Mr. Pangman.
Thank you, Justices. I am the respondent in this case. My name is William Pangman. Now, last night as I was preparing to address you in what is certainly one of the most important occasions in my career, each of my three kids came in and sat down with me, and for over an hour we laid around and we talked about all the silly things that kids talk about. And as they went off to bed, I reflected that I made the right decisions through this. That's what it was all about to me. It was a choice whether to place preeminence to my career or to my career as a father. I would hope that it is as much a concern to each of the justices here that a lawyer would be placed in such a position to have to make a decision between responsibilities to conscience, to responsibilities as a father, to responsibilities to what's right, and that should be juxtaposed against supposed competing responsibilities to a profession. Now, I've been impugned as not having respect for lawful process. I can tell you, if I didn't have respect for lawful process, I wouldn't have taken the time to have assembled the legal arguments, to attempt it, to allow the system to live up to its ideals. I wouldn't have taken the time to assemble the arguments, and what I can assure you was an extremely exasperating experience for anyone to try and defend themselves in such a situation. I would hope that the consideration is not whether I have respect for the legal process, because I think you will see in the record and the arguments I've assembled that that is what I am trying to invoke, is resort to that process. But the question may come down to how much do various persons within the judiciary have to that legal process? How much respect? The referee said the crux of the complaint against me is, number one, the respondent intentionally violated circuit court orders. Number two, he says, respondent overtried the post-divorce proceedings, is the other aspect of the complaint. And the third and final one he sums up as the respondent made comments demeaning to the judicial system and engaged in disruptive conduct while in court. Now, I certainly acknowledge many of the words I used and the criticisms I lodged were hard. And I stand by each one of the words and each one of the criticisms that I've advanced. And oftentimes I very reluctantly advanced those criticisms, attempting as best as possible, as lawyers usually do, to pussyfoot and to couch things in delicate ways. And sometimes, by that process of euphemism, avoid cutting to the quick. And so I was accused then of overtrial, as if I alone was responsible for the protracted litigation that at all times through this disciplinary proceeding I tried to demonstrate was not my design, was not my goal by any means. And I was prevented. That was just one of the defenses, the extenuating circumstances which I sought to advance in these proceedings that I was stonewalled from presenting. I ask as well the extenuating circumstance of what was going on as I, not as counsel, but as litigant and as father, tried to contend with a very difficult situation. I would hope this court could well appreciate the predicament that I was in. It was just about a year ago that this court decided the Momstick Cup decision that vindicated parental rights and found that it is prohibition of appointment of counsel in a CHIPS proceeding was unconstitutional. This court, citing Santowski versus Kramer, quoted with approval the following language: when the state moves to destroy weakened familial bonds, it must provide the parents with fundamentally fair procedures. And this court, also quoting Lassiter, acknowledged that parents involved in such proceedings are thrust, quote, into distressing and disorienting situations, and that once freedom of liberty is implicated, numerous additional due process concerns arise. Certainly that rings true to the circumstances that the record here reflects I was wrestling with when at the January 30th, 1995 proceeding, I said, quote, obviously my head is spinning by the kind of proceeding that I am, and I was cut off. And it's becoming clear to me only now that this court does intend to proceed in a way that will seek to impose such a maximum jail sanction upon me, a sanction which gives rise to due process procedural protections, including the right to be represented by counsel. And apparently I'm not doing a very effective job trying to represent myself, trying to make myself understood in a way that will be effective with this court. And I thought that perhaps naively, like most people who try to represent themselves, they think that they can just come in and kind of clear things up, and it seems as though I'm not able to do that very effectively, and perhaps I'm not able to think very clearly when I'm under this imposition. The imposition I was under that day was apparently 5 days earlier, Judge Landry held some hearing without any sufficient lawful notice to me, one in which I couldn't attend and didn't attend, and one in which the judge made a finding that I was in contempt on limited information and sentenced me to jail. It seems, of course, by all the circumstances, that that was a punitive sanction, that I was to be punished for something, for contempt. Not that it was remedial, whereby there were purge conditions. It was clearly a punitive sanction, which the courts have properly held can only be sustained if it is pursuant to those fair procedures that this court recognized as necessary in that context. Fair procedures that means following the prescribed law, conducting a real due process hearing. In the absence of that, it is void. It is unconstitutional. It is not worthy of regard as a binding law. And that's the type of proceeding that typified many of the other orders that I first tried to get the court themselves to correct, and when they wouldn't, tried to get appellate review to correct, and when it still wouldn't, and I was confronted with unconscionable circumstances that asked me to basically abandon my conscience and my responsibilities to my children, I made the choice that the professional rules permit, which is to openly say, this is not a valid obligation that binds my conscience. I will not abide by it. And indeed, I met my moral responsibilities to my children who lived with me, unfortunately without so much as a by your leave to the courts who would issue ex parte, summary, unwarranted, unlawful orders, doing such things as wham-bam suspending placement. No one in this entire disciplinary proceeding has ever suggested that any of these orders were really valid, you know, pursuant to proper exercise of jurisdiction, pursuant to authority under the law, that they were conducted under lawful proceedings. No one ever has offered that. They have simply said, well, they are orders because someone announced them, someone in authority.
Mr. Pangman.
Yes.
As I read the order, I should say order, the report and recommendation of the referee, there are five counts. Count one relates to comments you made about about Judge Gerlach, and on that, Judge Volke found that you had violated the rules. On counts two and five, which related to disobeying various orders relating to visitation and support, and that's why I interrupted you now, because it seems to me your comments go to those two, but maybe not. Referee Volke found that you were not in violation of the rules.
Right. The board takes issue.
The board cross appeals, and that's in their brief. They have two briefs combined in one. And is that to which you're directing these remarks? I'm just going to clarify the proceedings.
I think the referee correctly in the first page of his decision summarized what the gist and essence of the complaint was against me. And you notice that when he summarized that gist, he really didn't come to any hyper-technical particular episode and say, this word, this act, was something that makes Pangman worthy of discipline. I will agree that perhaps the most particularized and specific complaint that ultimately got distilled down primarily in the board's briefs in this now proceeding, this stage of the proceeding, is the Gerlach complaint. And perhaps for that reason, because the whole case was primarily just a crux type of complaint against me, as the referee summarized, I have spent most of my time dealing with that crux, with those broader issues. But I will focus for a moment on the Gerlach complaint then, because, again, elsewhere in the board's complaints and proceedings here and elsewhere in the referee's findings, he just basically says that I was disrespectful. He can just tell, disrespectful to the legal process. Certainly that can't be something that is beyond the scope of the protection of the First Amendment. Certainly it can't be something that lawyers can be disciplined for as their thoughts. And certainly, even if I have those opinions, there cannot be a content-based proscription of a criticism I might have. The First Amendment protects it, and the public's right to have lawyers make those criticisms, I think, insulates any such comments. But one specific comment I am charged with making to Judge Gerlach was in the context of a recusal motion, one that I submit should be certainly protected because it is in the nature of a legal pleading. How else do you raise issues but in ways at times when the very nature of recusal is something that judges are likely to be offended by? So, I'd offer to the court the admonition of the Offutt Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, that said judges also are human and may, in a human way, quite unwittingly identify offense to self with obstruction to justice. It is only, of course, obstruction to justice that could possibly be something that could outweigh the other First Amendment protections. I did not obstruct justice. I raised issues, and I raised them in a list of, I think there were five, reasons why Judge Gerlach should recuse himself. All of them were quite inflammatory. They said things about his attitudes and the way he conducted the proceedings. The board apparently had no objection to any of the first four, which should be context for what I was dealing with, if those first four were sufficiently merited to not even be part of this action. The last one is the only one I stated with that hedging qualifier that we use in the law upon information and belief, which is the way in which you raise an issue that you don't yet have completely discovered, but want to make sure you've preserved. And I did it in a way completely different from the type of criticisms that lawyer in the Sandlin case raised. Lawyer in Sandlin did things that I didn't do. And you may notice that there was even a very intelligent concurring and dissenting opinion that said, you know, we can't really even sanction that lawyer in Sandlin. Even though what he did was basically go on a campaign and an assault precipitously to slander that judge. Even though that lawyer knew better, but he went about a process to have that judge prosecuted under the law. I didn't do that, and I would like to cite a number of factors that distinguish what I did and what the court found so objectionable by the Sandlin attorney. My motion was something that was not carefully orchestrated. It was very hurriedly prepared when I learned that I was going to be back in front of that judge, where I never expected I was going to be back in front of that judge, and the issues I was going to raise concerning the omissions from that transcript I had hoped to present to an appellate court. But all of a sudden, I'm going to be back in front of that judge, and everyone knew that was not going to be a pretty picture. So I hurriedly prepared a motion for recusal just a few days before we were going to appear. I used the hedging qualifier of information and belief. That's number two. Number three, I went to my trial counsel, Rick Kaiser, a lawyer of 150 jury trials, trial experience, and said, Rick, look, here's the excerpt we get. It's not here. And, you know, that's obviously an important thing we're going to need. Rick, I just want to confirm my recollection with yours. That's exactly where it should be, right in the middle of this here. He agreed. He was concerned that it wasn't there. I told Rick that I had tried to talk to the court reporter and said to her, it's not here. Where is it? She says, yeah, I know. I thought I'll have to look and see where it might be, was the type of... she said she'd get back to me, and I shared that with Rick.
Mr. Pangman, let me interrupt and ask you, what you're talking about right now, does that relate to specifically some comments that Judge Gerlach allegedly made during the time he was rendering his decision?
Yes. He blew up at me. Rick Kaiser described it as an explosion. The transcript of the 17th, I think it's page 33, and those other pages, has Rick Kaiser's explanation of what went on, where the judge just vented and emotionally blew up and said, you're going to have to go stand out in the elevator. And do you understand me, Mr. Pangman, this kind of thing? And the response that the transcript reflects is, I said, yes, I understand.
It was this actually during the time he was rendering his decision?
Rick Kaiser's recollection is exactly that. He said that, yes, he understood that that this decision was being made at that point, and that certainly the reflections that the judge was sharing at that time were revealing his reasoning process and were going to be indispensable to me having an opportunity to have that aspect of the record reviewed. Specifically, at page 43, he said, this is Kaiser, he says, well, I thought it was important, and I was disturbed that it wasn't in there when I heard that it wasn't in there. Not that at the time anyone was thinking anything sinister could have occurred, but it was part of the record, and it came at a time when he was making his ruling, and in my mind it would have evidenced part of the basis for his ruling. And yes, it's disconcerting when you look at a record and it's not complete, and you thought you were getting a complete record, and I thought it was important to try to get the whole thing. I concurred with that. There's elsewhere that Rick described how he thought that this impacted on how an appellate court would look at this, because it would show that the judge was acting from an extremely emotional level rather than a rational basis at that time. Well, the judge apparently got mad because I was pointing at something on Rick's legal pad. He started ripping into me on a letter that had been submitted to my ex, saying I would like to provide for the support of the children, all of their support, but not pay any more money to you that would result in a maintenance component. And he didn't like that letter. In fact, not only did he not like it, he went on saying that was the most disgusting, degrading piece of literature he'd ever read in his entire 25 years on the bench.
Do you have a transcript of the comments of the judge?
Yes.
Is that in our record?
I believe that I have it, hopefully in one of the aspects of the appendix, but yes, it certainly is in the record. And that was the type of emotional response that we wanted, a piece, we needed that to show, hey, this was not just a rational decision, this was an emotional decision by a judge, and therefore fits the standard of abuse of discretion. We didn't have it, and I would like to just go on as to the other ways in which my conduct in raising this issue was different from Sandlin's, which might be sanctionable. I couldn't wait for a transcript. We tried to get one, but we had to now appear in front of a judge on this recusal issue, and numerous times during the recusal hearing, I urged that we wait for a transcript, that we engage in discovery if that's it. I did not wish to offend the judge any further, but the issue's been raised. Now let's set it on for discovery if need be. I also, this is important, Judge Gerlach acknowledged that under SCR 71, he's the one who's the responsible party. I couldn't be criticized for saying that the judge had a role in the record. He emphasized that he himself was the gatekeeper of that record. But more than that, the judge acknowledged that he was going to be the one to order the transcript and that the judge had reviewed the transcript and was satisfied with its inclusiveness. So he'd already made a decision that everything that needs to be in there is in there. So what I did was raise the issue. And the important thing as well is in Sandlin, Sandlin eschewed opportunities and chances to investigate the facts. He rejected the opportunity given to him to do further investigation before he launched off trying to get that judge prosecuted. I never did that. And he also says, in Sandlin, there also were situations where that lawyer was withholding certain information, overstating what another expert opinion had been given to him, and that was false.
Now, you know, of course, that the referee, in looking at count one, which we're talking about, right?
Right.
Determined that Gerlach directed the reporter to make a copy of his decision, that these comments about you were not part of the decision. Therefore, your statement, which is upon information and belief, Judge Gerlach directed the court reporter to remove portions of the official transcript and has otherwise obstructed the timely availability of the verbatim full transcript, purposefully sanitized the record and frustrated you. His finding was that falsely accused Judge Gerlach, both orally and in written form, with tampering with the record.
Right.
And you deny that.
I do.
You deny.
I do absolutely.
You think that the record does not support that finding of fact and conclusion of law?
That's right. I don't believe it does. But beyond that, even if it did, the legal issue here is that you can make allegations that ultimately turn out to be false because the First Amendment protects it. And my statements were not recklessly made, but even if that's the standard, recklessly made, if they turn out to be incorrect, they should not be so chilled.
Well, counsel, putting aside the concept of protection in a judicial proceeding, let's just put that aside. If we just view Judge Gerlach as a public official, your free speech is to make statements but not with malice, meaning not false, knowingly false, or reckless. So I don't see how that standard fits with your free speech. You don't have free speech to defame, aside from the judicial proceeding.
I harbored no actual malice, and the record doesn't show that I did.
It's not the standard, Mr. Pangman, actual malice meaning ill will.
I think it may be and should be, and there's authority for that to be the standard. But beyond that, What I did in this situation, the record demonstrates, is try to raise an issue. And I had good reason to believe, upon information and belief, that the judge, in fact, did take a hand in deciding, oops, that's embarrassing, I'm going to draw the line here. Look how close it is. If he'd added a couple extra words, it would have been in there. He decided not to add it. Rick Kaiser, who was there, my counsel, agreed that he felt it was important. I think any sober reading of it would determine, yes, it was something that was important to be considered. To look at the emotional state, look at what the judge was going off on, and look at, compare the letter and see whether or not that was even a well-founded basis for the judge to announce the things he did. The bottom line is, I also had other people who had reported to me that this judge had done such things with their records. I didn't know for sure whether he had done it in this case, but I had information and I had good reason to believe it. And the full context of the case would support why I did that. I would like to emphasize that if that is the issue, if the statement that I made is the only issue, then all of the consideration should have been focused on that. If instead they wanted to suggest that because of my other criticisms of the Milwaukee Family Court process and some of the judge's own conduct of those proceedings was relevant, then certainly the other factors that I wish to bring in, the other extenuating circumstances to explain why it is that I raised those issues and raised them in the way in which I did, why it is I had the belief or was reasonable in having the beliefs I did about the judge's animosity. Lo, if you could have seen that judge's reaction even during the proceedings before the referee, you'd know where I'm coming from on this. That certainly people can disagree on whether or not the judge made a conscious decision to excerpt those portions, but I think there's sufficient record to demonstrate that I had information and belief.
Mr. Pangman, thank you. You know you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. I'm going to ask you, so I prepare you, to discuss, if you would, your view on the recommended suspension of 6 months versus the 90 days the board had originally asked for, or whatever the appropriate remedy might be should the court not hold in your favor. Mr. Mozinski, you represent the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility.
May it please the court, good morning. Before beginning my presentation, I would like to ask a question of the court as to procedure, and I'll address this to Chief Justice Abramson. Insofar as the board is a cross-appellant in this matter, is the board also allowed a five-minute period of rebuttal after Attorney Pangman's period of rebuttal?
It's been a while since we've had that, but I'll give it to you.
Thank you.
Do you have any objections to Pangman? Okay.
As stated, I am Attorney Richard Mozinski. I'm from Manitowoc, Wisconsin, and I appear for the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility, whom I have represented throughout these proceedings. My argument today will consist of two parts. First, I will respond to Attorney Pangman's appeal issues as he's raised them and also discuss them here today. And second, I will make a presentation concerning the Board's cross appeal. On August 24, 1993, Attorney William Pangman filed a motion with the Milwaukee Circuit Court to seek recusal of Judge Gary Gerlach. And that motion, as discussed, stated in pertinent part, in quotes, upon information and belief, Judge Gerlach directed the court reporter to remove portions of the official transcript of court proceedings and has otherwise obstructed the timely availability of a verbatim full transcript to purposely sanitize the record and frustrate petitioner's announced intentions to seek effective appellate relief. End quotes. It was a bold statement. Although prefaced by upon information and belief, that phrase does not make the statement the hedging qualifier as respondent now refers to it. There's nothing either hedging or qualified about the statement contained within respondent's motion for recusal. His statement was not supported by any reasonable factual basis when inquired of at the August 30th, 1993 recusal hearing. In fact, Attorney Pangman's statement was shown at the disciplinary trial to be flat out false.
You have a, does the record include the full transcript of that hearing before Judge Gerlach?
Yes, it does, Chief Justice Abramson. And that record, I believe, does show quite clearly that the comments made by Judge Gerlach were prior to and not part of the decision that he was rendering on child support.
Is this part of the record before us that the board has presented?
Yes, it is.
Do you have a page number? Don't look for it now. You can give it to me later.
Okay. There were several witnesses that testified at this trial, this proceeding, whose testimony I think was quite pertinent to that very point. One of them being Judge Gerlach's longtime court reporter, Carol Pacetti. She was quite specific as to her instructions, namely that she was to type up a copy of the decision of the proceedings on May 24th, 1993, which related to child support in the Pangman post-divorce matter. And she disputed quite strongly and emphatically that any hearing transcript was sanitized. Attorney Pangman's own witness, his then counsel, Rick Kaiser, did not support the sanitizing claim. Contrary to what we've heard here today, Justices, Attorney Kaiser did not support in any way the accusation that the comments made by Judge Gerlach were part of the decision. Granted, he did say that the comments he thought were important based upon the portion of transcript that Attorney Pangman read to us. However, in response to cross-examination, I asked him if they were part of the decision. I asked him if they were part of the reasoning process, and in both instances, he indicated that they were not. He clearly testified that they were comments that were leading up to, but not part of the decision. Basically, they were an admonishment. It consisted of two parts, one being essentially, and I'll paraphrase, Mr. Pangman, if you don't stop your emoting, I'm going to have you go and stand back by the elevator. And the other part of the comment had to do with a letter that had been written as part of the post-divorce proceedings with which Judge Gerlach had objection. Having stated that, Judge Gerlach then began with his analysis and addressed, for the record, his decision. And again, in response to your question, Chief Justice Abramson, I believe the record does reflect that.
Counsel, upon information and belief, Judge Gerlach, this is what Attorney Pangman said, Judge Gerlach directed the court reporter to remove portions of the official transcript of court proceedings. He doesn't say anything about the decision in that allegation. He's saying the transcript of court proceedings. Is that true or untrue?
It's untrue.
What part is untrue? What did the court reporter, referee Volke, said clearly did not want to be part of this proceeding, and he was impressed with it. What did she say about any direction that Judge Gerlach gave?
The direction that she was given was to type up the decision, the court's decision as to child support. It was not meant to type up verbatim every word that was said in the proceedings on May 24th, 1993. But it was clearly stated, and the direction to the court reporter clearly given was to type up the decision. And that's exactly what she did.
Now, what is Mr. Pangman supposed to do if he has heard or does believe that she was directed that in that way? How else is he to raise the issue?
Well, Justice Babich, let me answer your question this way. The transcript was prepared by the court reporter and mailed out by her testimony on approximately June 10th or June 11th, 1993, which means that Attorney Pangman would have had the benefit of that transcript shortly thereafter.
The transcript, which is just of the decision, how long was that?
Correct. The transcript itself, best estimate. estimate 15 to 20 pages.
And how long was the hearing?
I would be guessing. I can't respond to that without speculating. But my point in response to Justice Babbage's question is, after having received the portion of the transcript of the decision that was typed up, Attorney Pangman then had, between that date and July 27th, 1993, which was the next scheduled court proceeding, to presumably review that transcript and look for any claimed deficiencies. There was a hearing on the record on the 27th at which Judge Gerlach stated that he had made three typographical corrections to the transcript after reviewing it. And they were essentially that. They were three words that he had changed that had, the court reporter had apparently mistakenly transposed some information. He told that to the parties on the record on July 27, 1993, and there was no objection. And there was no reasonable explanation given by Attorney Pangman when cross-examined at the disciplinary trial why there was no objection. So we then have July 27th, which comes and goes, and we get to August 24th, approximately 1 month later, when the motion is being prepared. Now, although Attorney Pangman argues here today that the motion was hurriedly prepared, there was no such testimony at the disciplinary trial, to my knowledge or recollection. I don't think there's any proof in this record that shows that his motion was hurriedly prepared. So you have a period of several months, essentially, that go by since this transcript was prepared, and then this motion comes out predicated upon information and belief. Why was this not investigated before such a certainly strong statement being made by counsel concerning the integrity of a judge?
Oh, my question, though, remains, how is he to... If you were doing it, how would you do it? If you're an attorney in front of Judge Gerlach and you believe Judge Gerlach has directed, somebody has told you that Judge Gerlach directed the alteration of the transcript, how would you raise that?
Well, my first method would not be to file a motion claiming that the record was sanitized. I would write to the judge, and I would direct to the judge an inquiry as to the portion of the transcript being prepared and ask for permission to approach the court reporter to see if there were additional stenographic notes which could be examined either by that court reporter or perhaps a different court reporter to determine the completeness of the transcript. But it certainly seems to me that it was going beyond the bounds to leap to the conclusion that the transcript was sanitized and then put that down on paper without making some effort to approach the judge and either by way of letter or by way of motion.
But the charge isn't leaping. The charge isn't being careless. The charge is falsely knowing. That's the finding.
That is true, Chief Justice Abramson. And when Attorney Pangman was questioned on the record on the 30th of August 1993 by Judge Gerlach, and there's a lengthy recitation of that in the record before this court as well, as to what is the basis for you making these accusations against me, there was no witness brought forth at that point that is now claimed by Attorney Pangman that could identify other cases where records were or transcripts were in some way sanitized or massaged. There was literally nothing brought forth by any fact on basis of any facts at all that would substantiate the respondent's claim. It was without basis. And so the end result of that hearing, as well as the investigation which followed, showed that there was no reasonable factual basis and that the statement made was false. It was not part of the decision.
So are you claiming that he knew that it was false, in other words, that he lied, or are you saying that he made this statement in reckless disregard?
I'm saying that the portion of his statement that the transcript was sanitized was false. When it was
he
made,
knew that it was false.
He knew that it was false. The portion of his statement that was also part of the excerpt that I read that said that it was done with the motivation to somehow effectively prevent him from getting appellate relief, which was his intention, was recklessly made. It was a speculation about the intention of the judge as to when he made the order to type up the decision, which was a reckless statement without
counsel,
any factual basis.
Counsel, the report and recommendation of the referee states that the respondent's public and written claims of wrongdoing by Judge Gary A. Gerlach were false in their entirety. That doesn't say the same thing to me that he knew that they were false. The finding is that they were false, that they were not true. But that doesn't necessarily flow that there is a finding that made by the referee that the respondent made them knowing that they were false.
You're reading from page 10 on the findings of fact.
Yes, thank you. How do you respond to that?
As I understand your question, Chief Justice Bradley, you're saying that the referee's finding falls short of coming to a flat-out conclusion of fact that the statement was false when made, but rather treated it as part of the context of all of the evidence that was produced in response to that?
No, thank you. Let me try to be more clear. That is, I read the finding on page 10 that the claims were false. That is, in my mind, different than a finding that the respondent made them knowing that they were false. How do you interpret the finding on page 10? The respondent's public and written claims of wrongdoing by Judge Gary A. Gerlach were false in their entirety. That's verbatim. Do you interpret that to mean that the referee found that the respondent made those claims knowing that they were false?
I think that's a fair reading, Justice Bradley, of what the referee is concluding. As a finding of fact, he is saying that the statement, when it was made, was false. And I believe that the record that was also produced and that's reflected in the referee's findings shows that there was no reasonable factual basis to conclude to the contrary.
Counsel, I can say that I believe today is Friday, and that's clearly false, but that's a very different thing than saying that I know that statement to be false. I may be having jet lag. Now, in the statement of Tim Volke was that the claims of wrongdoing were false, but he says nothing about the state of mind regarding Mr. Pangman.
And the reason that's important, counsel, or maybe important, is that SCR 20:8.2, which is the code provision that we're under, prohibits a lawyer from making a statement the lawyer knows to be false, or with reckless disregard as to its falsity. That's why we're emphasizing it. I mean, I think that's why I'm emphasizing the point. I assume that's why my colleagues are emphasizing
that point. The elements of the offense.
And I appreciate the question from the justices and the need for clarification, but given the record and given the trial that occurred in this disciplinary case, there seems to be no evidence whatsoever that would suggest that the statement, although false, was in some way mistaken, because the information was certainly within Mr. Pangman's disposal to make a determination as to whether or not a transcript was sanitized prior to making that allegation. And to come back later and say, well, it was a hurriedly prepared motion and I made it on information and belief, when he had a duty and an opportunity to investigate it, and when his own counsel, when cross-examined at the disciplinary trial, refuses to support that conclusion, Mr. Pangman could have talked to his own attorney and say, Mr. Kaiser, what's your view of this? Do you think that these admonishing statements that were made by Judge Gerlach were somehow falsely or somehow improperly removed from the record or from the transcript, and what can we do about it? So it seems to me that if we do sort of a backwards logic here of saying, okay, the referee concludes that it's false, but is there some possibility that it was false but mistaken, there is no evidence in the record that would lead that to be a reasonable conclusion.
But where does the burden rest, counsel? Does the burden rest upon Mr. Pangman to show that that they were not knowingly false, or does the burden rest upon the board to show that he knew they were false?
Justice Babich, the burden always rests on the board to prove each and every element by clear, satisfying, and convincing evidence, and we accept that burden. But it seems that if one fairly views the record of all of the witnesses who were questioned, including Attorney Pangman, his counsel, the court reporter, Judge Gerlach, there is no reasonable evidence in the record to conclude that this was somehow a false but mistaken statement. It had to be, based on the evidence that was presented, a false statement that was knowingly made, and that's the only reasonable conclusion that I think is possible from this record.
Mr. Rosinski, is this a subjective standard? That is, you have to prove as to Mr. Pangman, or is it an objective, a reasonable person?
That's a good question, Chief Justice Abramson. There's been some discussion here today about the applicability of First Amendment protections for the statement that Attorney Pangman made. And those First Amendment protections are, in fact, acknowledged in the federal case law, including the Sandlin case, which Attorney Pangman referred to. But that Sandlin case also goes on to make the statement that although an attorney does not surrender his freedom of expression once the attorney is admitted to the bar, the attorney must temper his criticisms of judge or judicial officers in accordance with professional standards of conduct. Goes on to state an objective standard applies in deciding whether an attorney's false statements about a judge's integrity or qualifications were made in reckless disregard of their truth so as to permit discipline of the attorney. An objective standard has been found to be the applicable standard in the Sandlin case, also in the Yagman case, which is another Ninth Circuit case. It's also been found to be such in by the Minnesota Supreme Court, who addressed that exact same issue in In Re, the disciplinary action against Graham, found at 453 Northwest 2nd, 313. Under this objective...
Same rule as ours, counsel?
I don't know if the rule reads identically to the Wisconsin rule or not. The case does address the issue of making false statements concerning the integrity of a judge. But to specifically respond to your question, Chief Justice, the standard, the prevailing rule, does seem to be the standard as an objective one. And that's been characterized in the cases I referred to as what would a reasonable attorney do under similar circumstances as Attorney Pangman found himself in. A reasonable attorney would not make a statement such as which was made without certainly much more thorough inquiry. And in so making that statement or that conclusion of opinion that I've just stated, I think that Attorney Pangman exceeded the bounds of any First Amendment protected expression. False statements are not constitutionally protected.
I agree with that, but that what you just said goes to reckless disregard, not known falsity.
Your question being then...
My question being, did these statutes, these cases go to the issue of did the lawyer make sufficient inquiry so that the lawyer, which would be objective, so that the lawyer was reckless? Well, what about on falsity, known falsity? Is that subjective or objective?
I would interpret the standard also to be objective, based on my view of the
case. Okay, sorry. I interrupted Justice Bradley. Counsel, I don't have that portion of the record before me. Mr. Pangman suggests that there were five statements made and that the fifth was made on information and belief, and which is the subject of our questioning at
Correct.
This time. Is that assertion consistent with your recollection that the first four, which the board is not pursuing, were averments without the qualification of with information and belief?
I would agree with that, Justice Bradley.
Mr. Mozinski, let me ask you if I might, because I know your time is running short, about count number four, about disrupting court proceedings. Can you tell us what the core of that particular allegation is? I understand it involves both Judge Gerlach and Judge Landry.
That is correct, and to get to the heart of it, or the core of it, as you requested, Justice Crooks, there was a proceeding held on January 30th, 1995, in the Pangman post-divorce proceedings. It was an extended proceeding. It took place over both the morning and the afternoon hours. During that proceeding, Attorney Pangman asked at one point if Judge Landry was awake or not, but he also did much more. He made a series of statements that were provocative to the court as well as that interrupted and disrupted the court proceedings. Statements such as, "I know the court is just itching to pull the trigger on me." He also insisted on arguing a motion that he had just filed at that proceeding for recusal of Judge Landry. He interrupted the other counsel as well as the court repeatedly, which Judge Landry commented on the record. And finally, as a result, as a last resort, I would say, Judge Landry called a bailiff, a sheriff's deputy, into the courtroom to restrain Mr. Pangman, and he made it very specific, Judge Landry did, that he was not bringing the bailiff into the courtroom because of a contempt finding based on disobedience of prior orders, but rather it was to attempt to deal with what Judge Landry referred to as the amazing behavior of Mr. Pangman, who in effect had been haranguing the court over a period of time and who had been interrupting and disrupting the proceedings. That, I believe, is the heart of the charge that was brought in count number 4, although the count also does refer to conduct before Judge Gerlach at an earlier proceeding where Mr. Pangman was apparently baiting and sneering the judge, according to Judge Gerlach's testimony, and egging the judge on, according to the testimony of his court reporter. At one point, Mr. Pangman making the statement to Judge Gerlach, "Are you perturbed?"
But counsel, the referee's findings with respect to that matter refers only to the conduct in front of Judge Landry. It does not refer to the conduct in front of Judge Gerlach in any way.
And I don't disagree with that, Justice Babich, but the record does also contain testimony by Judge Gerlach, as well as his court reporter, as to what occurred in proceedings before him on August 30th, 1993, and that was part of the board's complaint as related to count number 4.
Are you then dissatisfied with the referee's findings?
No, I am not. Not on that point, Chief Justice. My comments were meant to fully amplify what was in the record of the disciplinary trial, but to the extent that the referee, as Justice Babich has indicated, confines his findings to the conduct that occurred on January 30th, I think there's more than ample evidence in the record to show that the respondent was disruptive to the court proceedings and disrespectful to the court. I would like to address... I would like to address, with whatever time is remaining to me, the board's appeal, and I think there are a couple of points that should be made with respect to those two counts which the board has asked this court to consider. We're talking about counts number 2 of the original complaint and 5 of the amended complaint. There were 4 incontrovertible facts which I believe the testimony showed. Number 1, Judge Gerlach issued a child custody and placement decision on May 21st, 1993. Number 2, Attorney Pangman violated that order and was found in contempt on January 25th, 1995. Number 3, Judge Landry issued a child placement order on January 30th, 1995. And number 4, Attorney Pangman violated the second order and was found in contempt on January 25th.
Are those dates right? The last one you gave was, the second to the last one was January 30th, 1995, placement order, and he was found in contempt on January 25th, 1995, 5 days earlier?
That was a misstatement. The order, Judge Landry's placement order, was January 30th. The finding of contempt was September 25th, 1995.
Mr. Mosinski, I'm going to give you a few moments just to... because we gave Mr. Pangman some to deal with this cross-appeal, and then we'll hear from Mr. Pangman, and that will complete it if that's satisfactory.
Thank you. I appreciate that. With my few moments, I would like to advise the court of the following. We've heard some argument here today, and there's been much made in the briefing of the fact that Attorney Pangman is claiming now that he had contested the validity of his obligation to comply with Judge Gerlach's and Judge Landry's orders. And in his trial testimony, he talks about appeals and requests for supervisory writs and habeas corpus petitions, which were filed even late into 1995. The board's position is that there was clear, satisfying, and convincing evidence at the trial that Attorney Pangman violated the Supreme Court rule, namely 20:3.4.
Let me ask you a question on this matter. Let us assume that, let's take it out of this case entirely, that we have Attorney Smith and Attorney Jones. Attorney Jones is in a hotly contested divorce matter, and he's represented by Attorney Smith. And the judge issues these kind of similar orders, placement orders and support orders against Attorney Jones, against Mr. Jones, who happens to be an attorney. Okay? He happens to be an attorney, but he is he's the one involved. And because he believes that these, for whatever reason, disobeys them. Now, is he subject to discipline, being a party?
That's an excellent point, Justice Babich, and it's one that I've given considerable thought to. My response to that is yes, and it's a twofold answer. Number one, the rules, including the rule in question, is quite specific when it says an attorney shall not. Now, that's distinguished from some of the other Supreme Court rules, which I don't have in front of me, but which the court can refer to, which state or are prefaced by, in representing a client, an attorney shall not. The rule in issue in this situation, in response to your question, is specifically addressed to an attorney's conduct without any differentiation as to whether that attorney is acting on behalf of a client or is himself or herself a party in the action. The second part of the answer is that, and I understand from Attorney Pangman's briefing in this matter, that he is, in effect, advocating for some form of a two-tiered standard when saying that it was a special circumstance that he was himself a party in the action. And I guess my response as part of that part of the answer is the rule doesn't in any sense or in any way sanction such a conclusion that somehow an attorney, by becoming a party, can remove from himself or herself the obligation to obey orders of a tribunal. If we were to have that, we'd have chaos.
Okay. Do you see this somewhat like our disciplining of attorneys for failure to pay back taxes, for failing to pay taxes, for instance? Is that an analogous?
I think that could be an appropriate analogy, Justice Babich. The rules are there to be applied.
Does that come under this provision, or doesn't that come in under a provision because they've been held for a misdemeanor or a felony?
I'm sorry, Chief Justice, I didn't understand your question.
Under when a lawyer doesn't file back taxes, and this court disciplines that lawyer. It's my belief, but I'll check the cases, that it doesn't come under this provision of the code. It comes under a provision of the lawyer committing a misdemeanor or a felony, not that he's violated the law. And if we accept what you say is true, counsel, then every attorney who fails to pay support as ordered could be subject to a six-month discipline or 90 days. Or something else. How many lawyers do you think there are that haven't paid child support in accordance with a court order?
Well, Chief Justice, I wouldn't even want to hazard a guess as to how many there are.
Neither would I.
Pardon?
Neither would I.
I would offer this, however, to you, that the Colorado Supreme Court did deal with a similar issue. And it's in a case that's cited in the board's brief, People versus Tucker. That attorney who failed to pay child support in disobedience of a court order was found to have violated the Colorado disciplinary rule and was required to, or was ordered suspended for a period of 6 months.
Was that attorney representing himself in the Colorado case?
I do not recall that, Justice Bradley.
What perspective, if any, should change since Mr. Pangman is representing himself in this case as opposed to being an attorney representing a client? Should we be looking at his conduct any differently?
Justice Bradley, perhaps for purposes of discipline, but certainly not for purposes of interpreting whether or not a rule was violated.
Well, how, for purposes of discipline, what do you mean by that?
If this court were to find that due to the type of the situation that the respondent found himself in, namely that being a post-divorce, which involved highly emotional issues and certainly things that any person would find themselves under terrific stress in terms of dealing with, that somehow deprived him of the objectivity to be able to appropriately deal with court orders or to deal with his obligations, that differentiates that situation from an attorney who's representing a client and can act more dispassionately, I can see where the court might justifiably look at that as being perhaps a mitigating factor. In saying that, I would also urge the court to consider that the two rule violations that we're alleging here for failure to obey orders relating to child custody and placement were alleged to have been committed over lengthy periods of time. They were not something where it was done on a quick or spur-of-the-moment basis, but rather it was something that developed, and it was a repeated violation. It occurred on two occasions. So there was considerable opportunity for Mr. Pangman, Attorney Pangman, to consider the impact of his actions in response to these court orders. Yet, at the same token, I have to acknowledge the court's concern that perhaps this is something that the court does need to look at as far as a potential mitigating factor.
Counsel, are there any other questions, Mr. Mozinski? Hearing none, I would call your argument at an end, sir. Thank you. Mr. Pangman?
First issue that was I'd like to just quickly address, question of what Ms. about the excerpt from Judge Gerlach. This is what Mr. Kaiser said in his testimony at page 43 of the 1017 proceeding. It was part of the record. It came at a time when he was making his ruling, and in my mind, it would have evidenced part of the basis for his ruling. Now, there were a number of questions here about the orders and response to orders, the events of January 25th. Again, I wasn't present at that proceeding, and apparently, even according to the referee at page 11, he summarizes that event and says Judge Landry suspended placement of the children with respondent. There was certainly no provision in the law for such an order to have been issued under those circumstances with no notice. I cite extensively the authority for that. Nor, under the circumstances, is there authority for the other aspects of the order summarized by the referee, that there was a 30-day jail sentence that emerged from that proceeding. That was the backdrop of what happened then on the 30th when we were assembled there. And I am criticized for my response to that proceeding. And, in fact, here is what various other participants characterized that proceeding to be. The court said, and I have this in a footnote of page 5 of the red brief I submitted, the court said, the procedure we are following today is rather improvised. Mr. Radke said, some kind of seat-of-the-pants type of custody proceeding. Mr. Riley said, wow, in reference to what was going on in front of Judge Landry. Now, I apparently am not any longer being impugned for my non-boisterous, courteous request to the judge as to whether he was sleeping. I had other witnesses who came in and were found to be extremely credible that acknowledged it certainly appeared as though the judge was sleeping. It didn't matter whether I was right, didn't matter truth or falsity. My inquiry was protected and privileged inquiry. It certainly led to the whole backdrop of everything that happened following that. But there was also other things that happened, such as I asked to have counsel, and that was prevented. And